Welcome to the final instalment of a two-part special edition of Meet the Writers. My guest today is the critically acclaimed author of 12 books. He became an instant literary celebrity in 1984 when he was just 29 with Bright Lights, Big City, a contemporary classic which has been described as one of the generation-defining novels of the 20th century. He published Brightness Falls in 1992, which ends with Black Monday, The Good Life in 2006, which starts with 9/11, and his most recent book, Bright Precious Days, is the third in the series, which revolves around Manhattan couple Russell and Karine Calloway. The new book, like its predecessors, is set against a major historical event, in this case, the financial crisis of 2008. The Calloways are still together. Russell now heads a small independent publishing house with a focus on literary fiction. The author has won awards and critical acclaim, has been published all over the world and sold millions. His works appeared in some of the most prestigious publications, and alongside his literary contributions, he's an expert on wine, writing a monthly column on the subject, currently for Town and Country magazine. He's written screenplays and appeared in the hit TV series Gossip Girl. He was named as a literary lion by the New York Public Library. Jay McInerney, welcome to Meet the Writers. Now, many of your characters seem to inspire other people. So, for instance, I'm interested in your relationship with Bret Easton Ellis and The Story of My Life, which, of course, has Alison Poole in it, which then he uses. How did you feel about that?
I felt a little funny about it when Alison Poole, protagonist of my third novel, suddenly appeared in American Psycho. And she was a minor character in American Psycho, but she was almost killed by Patrick Bateman, which would have been disturbing to me. I think Bret really liked that character. Then she reappears in his novel Glamorama, and she's actually a pretty major character. And Bret being Bret, of course, she's much darker in his book than I think she is in mine. But I think that one of the things he was doing there was this moment, a long moment in the 80s when Bret published Less Than Zero, 9 months after Bright Lights, Big City came out, and suddenly the press identified this movement, and we were eventually called the Brat Pack. Not necessarily a term that any of us love, but I think that this is kind of Bret's way of like thumbing his nose at the critics and sort of saying, you think we're interchangeable. Well, here's, I'm going to interchange characters. And that's kind of my guess. You know, he's always been a little cagey about it. And then of course, I appear in one of his novels under my own name, which was also a little unsettling. Not least because the Jay McInerney in the book was very much the sort of caricature of Jay McInerney that snorts cocaine off the hood of a Porsche and falls in the pool drunk.
What about Tom Wolfe? Did you inspire, do you think, Bonfire of the Vanities?
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but I remember meeting Tom Wolfe in 1985, and he said to me, man, he said, you figured out the subject that was underneath everybody's nose. And he said, there hadn't been a New York novel in so many years, and, you know, way to go, kind of. And for many years before that, Tom Wolfe had been running around declaring that the novel was dead and that journalism, the new journalism, was the thing. So I think it might have helped nudge him toward the idea that the novel wasn't dead. And, you know, Bonfire of the Vanities was a very substantial achievement and a book that I really admired. Which in turn, I think, made me think about broadening my canvas, which I did in Brightness Falls, the first of these novels about the Calloways. The inspiration for that book really was I was reading Thackeray and Balzac and Trollope's The Way We Live Now, and Bonfire of the Vanities was in my mind as well. And I just thought I wanted a broader social panorama for after Story of My Life and Bright Lights, which were, you know, very narrowly focused, voice-driven novels. And suddenly I wanted to widen my focus. And I saw Ronald Perlman, the billionaire investor, and a homeless man standing side by side on the street one day while I was waiting to cross Fifth Avenue. And my thought was, I want to write a book that includes both of those characters. In New York, you have these juxtapositions. But, you know, you need something in the middle between the homeless guy, who appeared in the book, his name is Ace, and the billionaire appeared in the book, his name is Bernie Melman, partly a nod to Melmut, the tycoon in Trollope's The Way We Live Now. I needed somebody in the middle, and that turned out to be these characters I'd introduced in a short story that I wrote right after Bright Lights, Big City, Russell and Corrine Calloway. And, you know, after Bright Lights, Big City, I felt like, you know, my own experience ceased to be entirely representative. I could no longer write about the aspiring writer who became a wildly successful novelist. And they became my surrogates, you know. They became my every man and woman, even though they're a little more glamorous and a little smarter, a little better educated than the average American.
In that short story, they were trying to give up smoking, something you feel
strongly about. Yeah. And then the smoking becomes a sort of metaphor for something else.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Corrine no longer smokes when she becomes or doesn't become pregnant, has twins, but through IVF. Now, I know that that's something that you've been through, too.
It is. My twins were born via IVF with a surrogate mother, something that was really radical at the time. My ex-wife, the mother of my children, conceived this idea, which seemed very implausible, and it succeeded, and it sort of got me to thinking about heritage, about what does it mean? Suddenly there are these new possibilities for thinking about nature, about lineage. You know, my ex-wife is certainly the mother of my children, and yet biologically she's not. And then I extended this idea. I thought it would be really interesting if the egg donor and the surrogate was Corrine's sister, which creates even more complications. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something I've teased out in the last two of these novels. Mm. I mean, one of my kids asked me recently, you know, are we the kids in the book? And which they don't want to go near. And I said, no. But but I said, you know what? A lot of what I know about kids, I know from you guys.
Yeah. What about wine? Where does what you know about wine come from and your huge interest in it?
Well, you know, it was a way of intellectualizing my hedonism, I think, and redirecting it. You know, there's only so much you can learn from vodka and cocaine. And wine is this endless subject, you know, that you can pursue as far and as deeply as you're interested, as your interest takes you. You know, I mean, there's the history, there's the aesthetics. It's a branch of agriculture. Meteorology comes into play. I mean, but really it's just the aesthetic experience is kind of the most interesting to me. And I think as a novelist, I'm interested in people. People make wine are often really interesting people, especially in a new world. It's always their second career. You know, they've been really successful at something else, and then they decide to make wine because they love it. Mm. So it's a story of passion. When I was first asked to write about wine by a friend of mine who's an editor, I protested that I didn't really know that much. But she said, you know, most wine writing is so boring. And she said, you know, you're good with metaphors, similes, the things that fiction writers tend to be good at. And one of the things that interests me is trying to find figurative equivalents for the experience of drinking any particular wine. Piling on these literal descriptors, which is what so much wine criticism is and used to be, is this mocha, raspberry, cinnamon, vanilla bean, whatever. I mean, it's terribly confusing to read these are very literal wine notes. And if you say that, you know, a lean Chardonnay, you know, resembles Kate Moss, you know, I think it makes more sense than talking about citrus and minerality, you know.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the aesthetics, and I was really struck by one line in Bright Precious Days, which is, no one has a primary aesthetic experience anymore. And Corrine wonders if that can be applied to food and drink.
Well, really, the idea there is that very few of us go to a restaurant or see a movie or read a book without having already gotten a bunch of opinions about it from the internet, from social media, you know, maybe from The Guardian or The New York Times. I think it's unfortunate that we seldom have a primary aesthetic experience, an unmediated aesthetic experience. Ideally, your tastes and your opinions are strong enough to withstand this barrage of previews, whether you're going to a movie or a restaurant. In this case, you know, Corrine is just talking about the very precious restaurant that Russell is excited to go to because it has a secret phone number and it hasn't really been written about.
Has the mood of the city changed? I'm thinking post 9/11, which of course is referenced in both this book and The Good Life, but the whole kind of secret restaurant, the whole conspicuous consumption part of the city.
Well, New York is just as superficial as it ever was. It's still a city in which almost everyone is chasing the newest sensation, looking for the newest thrill, the latest restaurant, the latest, you know, in the circles Russell and Corrine travel in, it would be also the latest novel, the latest independent film. And New York is still the center of the art world, the publishing world, financial world, and that makes it exciting. You know, it's a lot less diverse than it was when I first got there. It's a lot more prosperous. And what that means is that a lot of the excitement of the, you know, generated by young, ambitious, creative people has been somewhat dispersed to the boroughs, notably Brooklyn. Mm. Brooklyn is exciting, but the problem is it's actually a very sprawling borough. And when I moved to New York, all the exciting things were within walking distance of Washington Square Park in downtown New York. And now you have these many different centers of youthful creative activity. And Manhattan has become, to some extent, a bit of a ghetto of the wealthier, more accomplished people. You know, young ballet dancers and editorial assistants aren't moving to Greenwich Village the way they did when I was 22.
You write about the dynamic of the art and love team versus the power and money team. That's still very much in evidence then.
Well, it's a kind of a joke in the book, but it kind of isn't either. You know, I mean, I think it's an interesting way of dividing the world up. Mm. I mean, those people who follow their passion and those people who follow their instinct for power and for acquisition. And you know, Russell and Corrine feel that they are on the art and love team. They feel that, you know, Russell loves literature and he believes that it's a higher calling. He believes that what he does is nobler than working on Wall Street, I guess. Mm. But because he's followed his passion, he finds that his middle age is not as plush and as well financed as it would be if he had gone into a more conventional field. You know, and suddenly the choices that they made when they were younger are kind of hardening around them and limiting some of their scope of activity. You know, suddenly they realize that they have children and they can't afford a second bathroom because Manhattan has become so expensive. Mm-hmm. They realize that, you know, if they want their kids to have a great education, they either have to move or they have to somehow come up with tuitions for the private schools. Mm-hmm. And so being on the art and love team has its consequences for them in this book.
Your current wife is the heiress, Anne Randolph Hearst. Are you the rich, that is, as F. Scott Fitzgerald puts it, different? Have you changed teams?
I don't think so. I think I was fully formed. I was pretty fully formed long before I married Anne. And in fact, you know, I met Anne in 1986, and Anne was living in a small one-bedroom apartment and working at Town & Country magazine, which her family happened to own. And I used to take her out to dinner. We were good friends over the years. And she had a very modest life until her father died. And I think she was fully formed at that moment that she came into her inheritance. And certainly I was when I married her 5 or 6 or 7 years later. So it's hard for me to identify with that, I don't know, with her heritage, her endowment in a way that somehow negates the first 45 years of my life. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's nice not having the wolf at the door. On the other hand, you know, I made several fortunes in the earlier part of my life. So it's not as if my circumstances have changed that radically.
Gossip Girl, you're not clearly doing that for the money, but what fun. Tell me about it.
Well, it was, it was one of the first TV shows in many years that really was a great New York show. Really smart writing, funny. It was kind of a satirical soap opera, as it were, about these young New York private school kids. And my daughter was a huge fan of the show, and it turned out that the creator of the show was a fan of mine. And he decided to write in a Jay McInerney character into the show. And then he asked me if I wanted to audition for it, you know, which which I did. But the writer was kind of this, somewhat, you know, the Jay McInerney caricature. And I said, look, the first thing I want to say is you got to change his name. If this character is going to be running around behaving as badly as you imagine I might have at one point in my life, then let's call him something else. And I did end up playing it was a recurring role. One of the kids in the show was an aspiring writer who worked as my intern. And it was a lot of fun. I don't know. I mean, and if nothing else, it really earned me the respect of my daughter, who has yet to read any of my books. But she and her friends were just, in their minds, this was my greatest accomplishment.
You talked about faking your way to authenticity. Mm-hmm. You're there now, though, aren't you?
I still sometimes feel that I can't quite believe I'm... I don't know, I can't quite believe I'm being interviewed about my life's work. It seems kind of implausible sometimes. I'm not sure if we ever really grow up. And I think that as a novelist, it would be too bad if I ever became complacent about myself or about my environment. I'd hate to ever lose my sense of wonder.
It's a book about happiness in many ways, bright, precious days. And I wonder if you've found yours.
Yeah, strangely, I think I have. I'm actually a very happy person. I've had, there is chronic depression in my genetic line, and I actually have suffered from chronic depression and was treated for it 14, 15 years ago. But in general, I think I'm an optimist and I'm a romantic, and I keep thinking that something great is just around the corner, and something wonderful is about to happen to me. I don't know.
Do you feel optimistic about the future of your country?
Ah, well, there's that. My country is... No, I'm not very optimistic about the future of my country right now because there's a sort of this poisonous political divide which seems to be getting worse. And I think that part of it has to do with the shrinking middle class, the American middle class being what held us together for so long. The current election presents not entirely palatable choice, although I personally believe that Hillary Clinton would be a very good president, or at least she's capable of being a very good president. On the other hand, if she's presented with a Republican-controlled Congress, then I fear that we'll have another 4 or 8 years of gridlock. And what's not plausible or what's horrifying to me is the notion of a sort of spoiled billionaire narcissist running our country. I don't know. It's possible, in which case I'm extremely pessimistic about the future of our country. I think he's a dangerous, dangerous person.
And really, do you think it is possible?
Unfortunately, it is possible because Hillary is not a great candidate. She has a lot of baggage. There are these persistent scandals that don't seem to me to disqualify her, and yet they are certainly dragging her down and... her favorability rating is below 50%, it seems. Lower than anybody else's except Donald Trump.
So if there were to be another one in the series, if there was to be one after Bright, Precious Days, which really is looking at the primaries, it's 2008, it's Obama, Clinton, might we be looking at a Trump scenario?
Yeah. It's funny, the reviewer for the Sunday New York Times actually said that he really hoped I would write another one. Both New York Times reviewers said that. But then the writer for the Sunday Times said that, on the other hand, he was a little nervous about my writing another one of these books because he said there was always a catastrophe that formed the backdrop of my books about Russell and Corrine, the first one being the stock market crash of 87, the second one being September 11th, and the third being the financial crisis of 2008. I think a Trump victory would count as a catastrophe and perhaps serve as the backdrop for yet another book. I'm not sure if I'm going to revisit these characters, but something tells me I will.
You've joked that your motto is eat, drink, and remarry. What would it be today?
what would my motto be today? I think eat, drink, and stay married is the new motto.
Jay McInerney, thank you so much. Bright Precious Days is published by Bloomsbury. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Claire Urban and Kieran Banerjee. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.